Hi guys, welcome to the Tales of an African Princess in America podcast. My name is OC. Today on the podcast, we're talking all about depression. A lot of times we talk about depression and we hear from healthcare professionals on this topic. But today I want us to talk about depression from the standpoint of someone who's been through it. I want us to hear from someone who actually has been through clinical depression. My guest today is Ms. Chinaza Onyebuchi, and I'm going to give her a chance to introduce herself in her own words. We'll be right back. Welcome back. My guest on the podcast today is Ms. Chinaza Onyebuchi. When I asked her to introduce herself, here's what she wants you to know about her.
Hi, everyone. My name is Chinaza Onyebuchi. I am a 35-year-old female Nigerian, and I'm an SME business consultant by profession. I support small businesses across Nigeria and the UK, and I operate virtually. So I think that's the basic about me, pretty much. Oh, and I am single.
I think that's a very important thing to put in there. I think that's great. Well, very nice to meet you. Do you mind if I call you Chinaza?
Yeah, that's all right.
Okay, so you said that you're into like helping small businesses. Tell me a little bit more about why did you choose to go into helping small businesses, and what was the whole idea behind starting that?
Okay, so in 2010, I actually gave a friend of mine a personal advice. Financial advice. She was looking for funds to do her PhD, and then she came to me looking for where to find funds. And then I was in the UK at that point. I said you could get credit card, you could get an overdraft, because she needed about £1,000 and she didn't even realize. So eventually I did an analysis of what the cost was going to be if she took a credit card and what the cost was going to be if she took an overdraft, and we looked at the cheapest option for her, and we applied, and she was able to get the funding that she needed. And fast forward to 2012, I had a friend who was running a business in Nigeria, and you know, he would always call me, you know, to help him do a few things and all that. And then I came back and helped him to structure his business, and then I realized, in the process of realizing, his company was registered with his children's names as directors. So when we needed to do a tax clearance for him, he couldn't get anyone, because it meant that children cannot be directors. I mean, they're minors, they're under 18 years. So right. some lawyer did that for him and all of that. And it was on the back of that that I realized that, hey, there is a lot that needs to be done in structuring African businesses. And it was from working for that guy that I actually gave birth to MJA Consults, which is my virtual platform. And it's been really an interesting experience. And basically, my goal is to help small businesses get structured and then take them from idea stage as well to profitable stage. And it's been interesting journey. I mean, I work for a number of businesses, and also taking like a small business from just an idea stage to actually a profitable business in Lagos, Nigeria today.
Wow. So it seems like you found out that you had this gift to help small businesses get a little bit more structured, and then you gave a couple friends, you know, good advice, and then from there it kind of picked up, right?
Yes, pretty much.
Okay.
And I have a finance background, so I've worked in financial services, mm-hmm. and I've worked in about 5 banks across Nigeria and the UK over the last 15 years.
Right. So the next thing I was going to ask you is, what sort of training do you have? Like, tell us a little bit about education. What did you study in school, and how has that helped you with this business that you run?
Oh, okay. For starters, I mean, I want to appreciate, well, thank God, because people say I'm really brilliant, I'm smart and all of that, or like I went to school very early, but mm-hmm. I just know that God picked me. I believe in God a lot is a key factor, because from where I'm coming from, I shouldn't be where I am today. Okay, so my mom is a teacher, so some credit also goes to her. But then I went to private schools all my life, except for my final degree, my MBA. But I also dropped out of school at every stage of my life, which is interesting. I know. So nursery school, I dropped out. Primary school, I dropped out. University, I dropped out. MBA, I almost dropped out. So like, I've had financial challenges for every stage of my study, and I'm in the process of doing my third degree. So from where I'm coming from, I mean, I shouldn't have an education, so to say, mm-hmm. in terms of education or qualification of what qualifies me to do this. I have a first degree in accounting from Babcock University, and I am a pioneer at Babcock University. And okay. then I have an MBA MBA from the University of Aberdeen, and I've also worked in financial institutions across Nigeria and the UK. So I've worked for Zenith Bank, I've worked for Lloyds Bank UK, I've worked for Rare Bank of Scotland, I've worked for Nationwide UK, and I've worked for Fidelity Bank in Nigeria. And I've also worked for ExxonMobil as a contract staff in finance. I worked as a contract accountant. Mm-hmm. I've worked on private audits. I served in the Ministry of Finance. So I've worked in a number
of industries. Wow, you're so experienced. I now see why it was natural that this gift that you had with the right training, it made sense to start your own business. Okay, so you mentioned something that was really interesting, that you dropped out at every stage. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Someone said to me recently that I was born with a silver spoon, and it's very interesting because I don't remember having a spoon, how much more a silver spoon. So my dad didn't have a secondary education. I mean, he didn't even have standard primary six, you know, like the first school leaving certificate. And according to him, then he used to drive in Concord Hotel in a way. And at some point he was passed on. He was run by the British then, but he was passed on for a position of a senior driver because he didn't have a standard six. And he made a decision right there and then that his children was going to go to school, at least university level. Mm-hmm. So dude, you know, tried to send us to private schools, but we could not afford it.
Right.
So I dropped out. So I was in school for a whole year or midterm. Eventually, like when the money came, we went back. And then primary school, you know, same thing. Well, I didn't do primary six pretty much. And then I went to a public school for like 1 year. And then I went to Adventist Secondary Technical College because my mom said the option we could afford was to go to primaries in like a public school for my JS1. And then I went to Adventist Secondary Technical College from my JS2 to my SS3. And then in Babcock University, I mean, like a lot of people don't know my story. So in third year, we dropped out because my parents couldn't really afford the fees. And so we withdrew and we're going to go to Uniports. But Uniports was on strike. So they were like a whole year behind. 2 months into like being at home and waiting to catch up for when Uniports will get to where I was, I had a pastor come to our house and say, what were you guys doing at home? I'm like, well, we're no longer in Babcock. Mm. We're waiting to catch up to Uniports where, and then we can join at 300 level. Because I left at 200 level. So we're waiting for Uniports to finish their academic year, which was probably going to take more than a year. Only God knows how long it would have been.
Mm.
And then he says, why? And then my mom like, we can't afford this school. So my dad had left, I think, 100,000, 50,000 for each of us for registration with Uniport, whenever it happens.
Okay.
And then the Babcock fees was a whole lot higher than that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the pastor says, hey, hang on, Seventh-day Adventists get discounts. And then you guys are the only ones from the conference in that university.
Mm-hmm.
So we could actually get a discount for you and give me a letter. I'm like, really? I've spent 2 years and I don't know that Adventists get discounts. So I took a night bus with my mom.
Mm-hmm.
I went back to Babcock, you know, then I tell people my 4 years in Babcock, I always took night buses. And sometimes I was always standing because we couldn't afford full seats and we couldn't afford to travel during the day. So I got back to Babcock the next morning. My brother refused to go. I mean, like, you know, the shame, you want to come back, like you got left school.
Mm.
I threw away my shame. And that's one thing I'm shameless when I'm chasing my ambitions.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to uni, wrote the application, and then got the letter and got the discounts, and I was able to register. So I used the 50,000 paid deposit for my brother, wrote our application, reapplication letters to be readmitted. And it was 1 month to exam for first semester, 300 level. So my mother went home and asked my brother to start coming. And I told him, you need to get here because exam starts in less than a month, because by then it was already 3 weeks rolling. And so that was how I went to live with my auntie, Mrs. Amanzi. I'm eternally grateful to her for keeping me. So that was how I lived with her throughout my 300 level. And then my brother stayed off camp, and then eventually at some point my dad raised the balance over time. So I think someone stood as a surety for us to be able to pay instrumentally. So that was how I went back to school and was able to graduate at 19, and then the rest they say is history.
Wow, you graduated at 19. That is amazing. It's such a motivation to hear you say that, you know, your dad couldn't afford it, but he knew the value of education. And that's something that I talk to a lot of people about. You know, I tell them that in a lot of communities, even in Nigeria, sometimes women are passed by with these kind of things. Like in that situation where your dad couldn't afford to pay for all of you, he would have said, okay, let me just allow the guy to get the education, because in most families they regard the, you know, male kids to be more important than the girls. But I see that in your family it's not like that. Male and female kids are, you know, encouraged to seek education and get a better life. So is it right to say that you being a female didn't affect, you know, your dad saying, okay, maybe one of you should stay back, maybe the boy should go ahead and get the degree?
I would say gender didn't affect my education. In fact, I actually offered for my brother to go, you know, with this whole mindset that, oh, I'm a woman, if I remember saying I can go and sell tomato tomorrow and marry, you know, it's okay, I'm at this age, it's all right. But my brother refused to actually go without me. But my dad, his own, you know, was like, he would rather we both went to public universities and at least both got an education than one person. And I'm thankful to him for that.
Okay, that's awesome. So now let's talk a little bit about why we're here today, depression. You know, it's really good to know a little bit more about you, because a lot of times people feel like, okay, this illness is illness for the rich. I can't relate with this, or, you know, there's nobody like me who has been through this. So I think it's really important that you just sharing with us a little bit about your background kind of helps people better understand where you're coming from. So let's talk about depression. I pretty much follow you on Instagram. And the first thing that I notice about you when I get to your page is that you're an advocate for mental health diseases. One of the things that you shared with me was that in 2012, you were diagnosed with clinical depression. And that is one of the reasons why you decided to become an advocate for mental health diseases. Can you please tell us a little bit about what happened after you were diagnosed with clinical depression?
Then I was given an appointment to come 3 weeks later to see the mental health GP. But then I went to London to stay with my brother and left Northampton. And a few weeks after, I went back to Nigeria and I never went back to see the GP. And that became the beginning of my tale of woes living with depression in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. It took years. I went from one church for deliverance to another because as far as they were concerned,
it was a spiritual problem. Mm-hmm.
Issue. Somebody was trying to mend my future. I mean, at that point, I had a job that paid me £250 per day. Mm-hmm. I had a UK permit up until 2015. So I abandoned it and came right to my village. It's not like I came back to Lagos. I'm from Abia State. So I went to my village in Obakalomwa here and stayed in my village. And I cried uncontrollably every day. I wouldn't shower. I wouldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And so I went through a lot over the years until it was my pastor in Abuja in 2016 when I decided to just run away and just abscond to somewhere. I just told myself, this church thing is not working or whatever. I mean, in between, I would go take some medication. I met a few doctors who were not psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. So they would just give me little medication and say, you need to go and see a psychiatrist. This could affect our license. But, you know, they would give me something. Like, when I actually went to see a psychiatrist and I started taking antidepressants and I started living a functional life, I couldn't believe that I wasted so much of my life. And for me, that was the backdrop of saying, if this could happen to me with my exposure, you know, with what I know, and having lived in the UK and had the option of even taking free healthcare, and I came back, how much more someone else? So, you know, people say, something major has to happen to you. And for me, I was at the peak of my life when this happened to me. And I tell myself, because living in Nigeria is hard. Someone says, like, living in Nigeria is enough problem on its own because of the non-functionality of the society. Mm-hmm. So if this could happen to me, how much more other people? And then I just felt a deep need to just share my story a little bit. It was hard. It's still hard. I mean, my last post, which I made, my brother literally asked me to take it down and all that. I get my family all the time doing that, saying I should take it down. And people tell me how it's going to affect my career as a finance person, as a consultant. You know, these days, people package imaging and all of that. But people started reaching out to me. And then I have people that I support, people who are dealing with this. And these are people that, like, are in good places financially or, you know, and other things.
Right.
And then I had a close incident, which I can't really share, like a close family member who died from suicide. But there are very few people in my family who actually know that it was suicide. Because, right. I mean, you can't talk about it to say someone killed herself. Those of us who found out about it on the point know that she actually injected herself to death. Mm. So for me, it was like, if it's one person that I saved from doing this and is what taking the risk, I don't think it's going to cost me my career. But if it does, then a life is worth more than career. And so that was what led me to do that.
Right.
And then over time, I've had people getting back to me. And then I also have the challenges of trying to get medication, also finding psychiatrists and all of that. So I'm beyond, you know, not even accepting. I realized that there was a big issue around this and I felt the need and a burden to share, because I feel like God had allowed me to go through this process to know what the problem are. Because anyone can just come up, like if you have the money or if you have the knowledge to say, okay, I want to do something around helping people with depression. But if you haven't there, you have no idea what people are going through and you're not in a position to help them. It's just like saying someone loses their father, and if you haven't lost your father, you go and say, oh my dear, I'm sorry, I know what you're going through. Hell no, you don't know what they're going through. So that's kind of why I became mental advocate. I mean, I don't describe myself as that, but I share part of my story. And every time I do, someone reaches out to me and I realize that someone is always on the brink of suicide. And you realize that they are with what you will call family in quote, or maybe in a good place in quote externally, but at the point of taking their lives, and reach out to people. And then you realize that for some reason, I mean, it's always strange. Every post I make ends up being like a relief for someone. And for me, that's the motivation to keep going. Even when, you know, like a lot of issues around my family not accepting it, or like friends being like, you know, this is not good for your image or your PR.
And you've struck so many things. Oh my goodness. I don't even know where to start. But let me say a little bit about growing up in Nigeria. There are a couple people that I heard took their own lives. And whenever that would happen, I would hear people talk about all the repercussions of this, how this person is going to hell because they've taken their lives. They're not even considering their parents. They're not considering their friends, how disappointed they were in the person. And so, you know, when you say something like family asking you not to talk about it, because of course it's their image as well. So you see, it's really, really important that you're doing this because a lot of people are going through that. Another thing I want to say is just this, you know, social acceptance. The stigma behind all of this. I know someone who has, you know, told me that she's wanted to post about depression several times, but her family is like, you know, you shouldn't be telling everybody this, you know. Not everybody should know that this is what you're going through. And because of that, a lot of people suffer in silence. And so I think it's really, really important that you're talking about this because it's something that needs to be addressed. I think it's something that people really, really need to speak up about. So now the question I have for you is, you know, speaking about depression now, do you feel like you have to disclose to your friends when you meet people for the first time? You said you're single. How has depression affected your relationships, be it professional relationships or personal relationships?
Thank you, Rosie, for asking that question. I think relationships is one of the hardest thing in this life, you know, like after any other thing that could be described as hard.
Mm-hmm.
I've lost a lot, but I think my friendships have been affected adversely. I mean, one or two friendships actually hurts me most, especially for them abandoning me at the peak of my crisis. But I've also gained friends, like true lifetime friends who were acquaintances at the stage of that, but who stood by me, who carried me, I mean, who found me even when I disappeared and isolated myself. Mm-hmm. And these people were across the world, you know, Canada, US. Mm-hmm. And while even I was in my village, I mean, I had a friend of mine call my mom. I didn't know, somehow he probably remembered he had my mom's number. Mm-hmm. And when he had emailed me and sent, called on my numbers and couldn't reach me for months, he called my mom and said he was trying to find me and what's going on with me. So in terms of relationship, it's been two ways. I've had some major losses, which were really hurtful, especially in a few friends who, you know, like people that have been your friends for over 10 years, people you've kind of helped financially, people you've planned your life with, people you've been there for. And it's not just that they left you, they treated you like a leper, treated you like you were mad because you were depressed. And so it's been hurtful, but I've also learned a lot and gained like people who are really your friends. Because for me, I have a simple definition of friend, a friend. Or friendship. Mm-hmm. A friend is someone that will be there for you at all times. And so that's why people meet me and say, hey, nice to meet you, we're friends. And I'm like, hey, no, we're not friends. We just met, we're acquaintances. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people get offended. And then I have colleagues and they were like, ah, we're friends now. I'm saying, no, if I leave this job and we're still talking, we could consider that as friendship. But if I call you at 2 a.m. or if you were called and said I was in trouble, would you come? No. If someone called me at 2 a.m. and said you were in trouble, no, because you're my colleague. Mm-hmm. But we were friends, then you should be able to come at 2 a.m. I should be able to come at 2 a.m. I mean, that's just a simple analogy. So in terms of relationship, personal, it's been two ways. There's been a lot of losses. There's also been a lot of gains. But I have lifetime friends and I have a huge support system. I mean, my friends that I've lost has been hurtful, but I've learned to move on and count my losses as well. Mm-hmm. In terms of professionally, it's hard keeping down a job when you're depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a few jobs when I was actually depressed and then I had a crisis. I remember taking a particular job. A friend of mine, I had lived with her. She was still single then when I was working ExxonMobil back in 2006. So I think in 2014, her husband set up a place and, you know, he wanted me to set up a telecommunications center for him and do a few things. So I'd come to Lagos, you know, they gave me a car. I was supposed to be hiring, doing interviews to get a driver and a few things. But I arrived and they gave me accommodation. I was living in a big house in Bagada. I had a driver taking me to work. So the brother was taking me to work in the interim while I was recruiting for a driver. So I wasn't stressed like in the Lagos normal stretching, but I was not mentally in that place. But before I came from Abuja, I was like, you know, ready. You know, we had had this conversation. I had packed up my things. I was ready for this. We had planned it for like a month or two.
Okay.
But I think what I've noticed is that Lagos is a trigger for me. So I arrived Lagos. I think I just had that trigger and then I would get there and I would be crying all day. And then at first it was hard. So, I mean, I can't just arrive, you know, you've been hyped, you have a new business manager and all of that. You know, when they read my profile, you'll be wondering, I'm coming looking all pang with my suits. And then I break out crying. So I hide in my office and cry. And by the fifth day, I was crying uncontrollably. So I went to tell her, I said, I can't do this. But I mean, even at that point, I couldn't share. My friend just said to me, she knows, pull yourself together. You can't be crying. You need to get your life back. You can do this. You used to wake up at 5 o'clock and work at ExxonMobil. I mean, you have, why can't you do something you can't do that? And I mean, I was crying uncontrollably and I couldn't explain why. And I started feeling suicidal, but I couldn't share that part with them that I was feeling suicidal because I used to write a lot. So I would journal, I would come to work and act like I was doing something, go to the toilet, cry, go to the boardroom, cry. And eventually I just told them, sir, I'm sorry, I can't do this. And I left. It hurt our relationship for a while. At that point, they didn't understand because as far as they're concerned, they just want to set up a business. And they were looking at like, we know you, you're brilliant, you do this and all of that. I went back to Abuja and I had a full-blown episode. I mean, for months, I didn't come out, I didn't do anything, and ended up in National Hospital. And it took almost 9 months of that year before I really got back to, you know, working again. And it can be hard because, especially people who know your professional capacity, and then if you have a crisis or a depressive episode, they can't reconcile it, can't understand it. And of course, because it's a business, it's not a charity, so their focus is on the losses they are making by having you.
Right.
And then you walk away from a business opportunity or from a work opportunity. They're also looking at the losses of personnel loss. I mean, because when a staff is not in, so they look at that loss. And for me, I feel that in Nigeria, because in developed countries, I mean, people will tell you to take, they'll ask you to take time off, you know, get your work done, get your health back. And they will even try to take you to get you to the hospital. For example, like in the UK, I mean, I knew they would get some time off, you were mentally ill, and then they'll get a cover for you. And you probably still earn money or half salary at least. But it's not like someone is not going to care about you. Because in this case, I mean, no one was even concerned about like what was really going on with me.
Right.
It's something I feel like is a major issue in Nigerian businesses, but in corporate organizations in court, because I've also had that experience in corporate organizations as well. So yeah, there is that issue, there is that negative and adverse effect for someone who's going through depression with their personal relationships and their work relationships.
Okay, so you talked about triggers, and just help our listeners understand, they probably don't have a friend who's ever suffered depression, or they don't have a family member who suffered depression, but they're hearing you talk about depression. Can you tell them a little bit about some of the symptoms that you experience and what your triggers are?
Thank you. First of all, I would like to start from defining depression from different perspective. So I like to start from the definition by bbc.co.uk. It says that depression is a mental disorder that makes someone feel persistently sad for several weeks or months. And there are many types and different kinds of it. And then the mindbug.uk also describes it as a low mood that lasts for a long time and affects your everyday life. And it says in its mildest form, depression can mean just being in low spirits. It doesn't stop you from living your normal life, but makes everything harder to do and seems less worthwhile. Depression is actually a mental illness. Depression is an illness. It's not a feeling. It's not something you imagine. And for Africans, Nigeria precisely, it is not a spiritual illness. It's not a village people thing. No one is trying to kill you. You know, uncle, no auntie is trying to take your life. Now, for some people, it might be a psychological issue. It might be a trauma. It might be something from the past or the present they're dealing with. It might be from financial loss or different things. But for other people, it might actually be a chemical imbalance in your brains, which in my case, it is a chemical imbalance. So my psychiatrist explains to me that, you know, it's called my serotonin levels and some other chemical components are actually low. And I think it comes from the fact that I've done high pressure jobs over the years. I mean, I graduated relatively young and I've worked in more than 10 companies, which are like multinationals to financial services. I'm good with numbers. And then I'm just hyper. So I can do so many things at the same time. I can work and work and work. I am very energetic and all of that. And over the years, I've just used all of that energy. I can't do one thing at a time, really. So even when I used to work in a bank, for example, I used to do multiple roles and I could post so many tickets in a day and people don't even understand. If my colleagues were posting 50 tickets, for example, I'll probably post about 150. Like if you're someone who's doing a highly pressured job, then you can stand the risk of, you know, the chemical imbalance, that's the clinical depression. In terms of symptoms, there's weight loss. For some people, it's a significant weight loss. For some people, it's less sleepy. So you have this tiredness and loss of energy. You have this sadness that doesn't go away. You have a loss of self-confidence and self-esteem. You have difficulty concentrating. Some people lose their memory, actually. You're not able to enjoy things you normally enjoy. Then you feel anxious. In my case, I actually had anxiety at some point. I mean, my hands were literally shaking and I wasn't able to hold things down.
Okay.
And then start avoiding people. Someone says, like, I'm a social media queen. I'm not necessarily like anything. I like social media. I mean, I did high five in the days of high five. I did whatever. Like, I sign up to these things. I just love to explore. I do e-dating and all of that kind of stuff. So, but for almost a whole year, I was gone. You know, at some point, I shut down from my phones. I wouldn't talk to anybody. During the days of BBM, I had a BBM group, and I like to send devotionals. So, I mean, I shut down all my phones, and I told my dad I didn't have a phone for months. He bought me a new phone, thinking I didn't have a phone. Of course, I had two phones in my bag. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to see anybody. And so that's part of it. And then sometimes you have a feeling of hopelessness. You feel like life is over. I packed all my things, gave my brother, and said, give them to charity. Told my dad this amount of money, give them to the church. I didn't want to do anything. I returned my UK permit. Who does that? I flew to the UK for 5 weeks, returned my permit, and came back to sit in my village. Of course, it was at this point that my mom was sure that the people that after her child have finally succeeded.
From the village.
All sort of churches. So, you know, sometimes people say, like, they're feeling sad or low. Everyone has stress and what they go through. But if you feel sad for, like, a few hours, a few days, you're not depressed. You're just, you know, stressed out or going through life. Depression takes a long period of time. So, and we're talking weeks or months. People attribute poverty, being broke, to depression. No, you're broke. You're not depressed. You don't have money. Especially in Nigeria, where, like, poverty is very high, or, you know, conditions are tough, society doesn't work. But if you're depressed, you can have a billion naira and be depressed, as in you don't want to touch the money, you don't want to have anything to do with the money. Right. So now you are broke. You need to think of, you know, solutions of how to get money. So you have a money problem or a cash flow problem, as, you know, the big people call it. So you are not depressed. And so for me, that those are the few things that, like, I feel like I want to talk about in terms of depression.
We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue talking to Ms. Chinazo about how dealing with clinical depression has cost her some friendships and relationships. Welcome back. I've been speaking with Ms. Chinazo Onyebuchi, and she's been sharing her journey with clinical depression. And I asked her, what were the things that triggered depressive episodes for her?
So I don't deal with stuff. I remember when I broke up with my very first boyfriend, I don't remember crying about it. And I just walked away. And I think it also explains why I move a lot. So I just move on. I don't have time to deal with stuff. And so, but I think, like, in recent times, so when I got depressed, a lot of all that started coming back to me. And then when I go to certain places, and Lagos, I got robbed a lot in Lagos. So that is why Lagos is a stressor for me. I got robbed like 3 times, you know. I got stabbed. I got an accident. I got shot.
Wow.
So every time I come into Lagos, I just feel like, I mean, if I'm in Lagos and it's like 7 p.m., I'm still on the streets, I get agitated because I'm wondering if someone is going to snatch my bag. If I'm carrying a handbag in Lagos, I'm always agitated. Like, I'm taking public transport. So I try to avoid public transport in Lagos. So I guess if I go to Lagos and I have to take public transport, I get agitated. I mean, the traffic is crazy. I hate the traffic.
Right.
So, and then I don't do goodbyes because I move a lot. So in terms of relationships and all of that, so I realized that, you know, saying goodbye is like, you know, gets you all mushy and all of that. So saying goodbye is the trigger for me. I remember if I want to go, I just tell you. I mean, I don't literally even tell my mom when I travel. I just call her from whatever location I go to. I don't know why. I think it's probably something that had to do with my childhood. You know, my dad traveled, and when I was 5, he went to Cameroon, and they told me he went to the village and he was coming. So every day I kept looking out for him, and he never came back for almost 1 year. So from childhood, I just feel like when people are going and saying they're never coming back. So for me, I don't want to put anyone through that trauma. So, but over time, that's why I realized that it's probably a challenge I have with saying goodbye. Recently, I met a friend who someone reached out to me that was having depression. And so when we started talking and all of that, I realized that, okay, she lost her fiancé. And she didn't deal with it when it happened. I mean, she cried and all of that, but she went back to work. So she didn't take time to go through the grief and all of that. And even she feels like, okay, she's moved on, but she hasn't, because, I mean, she hasn't really been able to date after then. So you realize that there's also, like, a lot of unresolved issues. Things or the places that causes a trigger for you makes you cry uncontrollably for reasons you can't explain. You know, it makes you feel very sad. Sometimes people have symptoms like, you know, shaking hands, you know, different things, sweaty. And some people hallucinate.
Wow. Okay.
So you hear voices that tells you things. And that's when, you know, for people that are suicidal, that hear voices, so they are a bit worse and on the risk side. So that's why you really stay in hospital if you're hearing voices. Because the voice might just wake up and tell you, go dip your hand inside some eyes of fire. And you don't have time to process it. And then someone looks at you and wonder, why would someone kill themselves in this kind of horrible way? I have no idea what they're actually doing.
Okay, so thank you so much for sharing some of the triggers with us. And some of the things that you said, they make so much sense to me. Unresolved emotions, like, things happen, you don't deal with them. Places, some places where you've had really bad experiences, just being back to those places could trigger depression. So now, being that we're both Nigerian, and we know that in Nigeria, a lot of people associate any kind of illness to spiritual problems or to some people from your village trying to get back at you and things like that. What are some of the things that people have told you about depression that you feel like this was not helpful at all?
Well, the starting point is people telling me nothing is wrong with you. So I think acknowledging that depression is an illness is a starting point. Just the way if someone had malaria, if someone had cancer, if someone had fibroid, you would say, oh, I'm so sorry about your health.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's a starting point, you know, if someone is depressed, to say, oh, I'm sorry about your illness.
And something I want to say is this, like, because depression is not something that you can physically, like, if someone is not close to you, they can't tell. So a lot of times you see someone who seems, like you said, you had a good job, you know, you seem to be living the life, and then you say, oh, you're crying uncontrollably, and then you tell someone, you know, I'm clinically depressed. To them, they can't see the signs of the illness, and so they feel like, is she making this up? Or so I think sometimes when people cannot physically see it, a lot of times when people cannot see that this is what is wrong with you, they kind of chalk it off to, she's probably doesn't know what she's talking about. But go ahead.
So, and depression is an illness you cannot see, so people should just acknowledge it. I think, like, when someone shares and says that maybe they're depressed, the first step is to actually check, is this person different from who they were? You look at their behaviors and actually look at what they are going through. But I think acknowledging and acceptance is the first step. So I also feel like, you know, telling people to snap out of it, it doesn't help.
Okay.
And someone, you need a job when the person is depressed, doesn't help. Because if you're ill, you cannot work. Telling someone to go and get married, get a husband or get a wife does not help. I know it's hard for families of people who are depressed, especially your immediate family. And I'm going to share this with my brother. I think, like, when I had my major crisis, I mean, there were times I couldn't be myself. There were times I would just cry for days and not shower, and then I live with my brother. But he could not understand. I'm eternally grateful to my brother, because I would have died in Northampton in 2012 if he hadn't come to pick me up. So I had attempted suicide twice in Northampton by myself, and then I was like, his girlfriend called me and I, like, casually said I swallowed 28 tablets of drugs. And then she was like, what? They drove all the way to Northampton to pick me up. But when he took me to London, I would just stare and sit on the couch in my PJ for days. And then maybe someday I have energy when he will scream and say, you need to bathe. You know, what is wrong with you? This? I mean, he didn't understand. It's hard for them because they can't reconcile who you become when you're depressed from who they know. But acceptance is the first step to say something is wrong with this person. It's not how my sister is. It's not how my brother is. I remember when I also went home, I mean, my mom was like, what's going on? She was more concerned about how I'm going to go back to work. And then she shut me out for a while. She will tell people, like, maybe close family, she will tell them I'm on leave. But other people, she will say I wasn't around. My auntie had to literally come for, I had this auntie that was already coming to bathe me every morning. If she doesn't come, I won't bathe. I'll just be in bed crying uncontrollable. And then at some point, when I'll see people, I'll be staring at them. I mean, I'll see you, I know your name, but I can't remember. And then I remember one of my cousins came and she sat with me and cried for like half an hour. We're just staring, she was just crying with me. But the fact that she sat with me and cried with me, trust me, it actually helped me, because we never said anything, but I just felt like she could feel my pain. She didn't know the right thing to say. So she just held me and cried and left. And to date, I still remember that as one of the best things she did for me. But I just feel like she shared in my pain. By just being there and crying, because she knew that, okay, this is not my cousin and I can't really understand. Acceptance is, for me, is the key thing. And then if you can share the pain, fine. But if you can't, then don't add to the pain with the kind of words you say or what you do. But it's important for us to acknowledge. And I understand that sometimes, for example, like, my mom couldn't deal with it. But, you know, she had this, my auntie, that always came in to help me. And of course, eventually, when my brother couldn't really deal with the situation, you know, he let me go home. But in hindsight, it was probably the best thing that happened for me to be able to get, you know, help from my family.
Okay. That makes a whole lot of sense. Like, now let's talk about the role, your support system. What role, you know, has your support system played for you?
I think my support system, I would say, are the reason why I still live. And literally, because in my major episodes, they've been the one carrying me. I think, like, they've been the one bearing the pain of my journey more than myself. Because the times where I give up hope for life, I cannot bathe, especially the times I isolate myself and shut out, they find a way to reach out to me. My mom, my brother is my first support system. For him to have come to get me was one of my saving points. And then when I came back, my mom actually helped. I mean, so many times she probably didn't help in the right way and all of that, but she did everything she could to try to help me. And eventually she had to come from Umuahia, which was like 12 hours, to Abuja to take me to National Hospital in 2016. I mean, I had the referral paper to go see the psychiatrist for like 2 months, but I didn't feel like getting out of my house. So for 2 months, I was shut in. I mean, once in a while, I'll go out, find something to eat, but I was practically shut in my house until she came. And I remember when she came, I thought I didn't have anything to wear. My hair was all cut. I was looking all crumbled. Mm-hmm. And then she was like, okay, she gave me her dress. So I literally wore my mom's dress. Mm. And she took me to the hospital. And then I have friends across the world. I mean, so I have this friend. Her name is Fumi Olide. So she's actually a doctor. But Fumi and I, we were in Aberdeen together. We did MBA together. Over the years, Fumi had moved a lot as much as I moved. I mean, she had been in Canada. She'd been in the US. She'd been in the UK over this year as well. But she had reached out to me. And she was the only person I could really open up to. It's just because she was a friend for me. I remember when I wouldn't talk to her for days. And she would call me and I would say, Fumi, don't call me again. Mm. Don't talk to me. Just leave me alone. Just let me be. And sometimes she'd call me, I would just cry. And all that. I remember when I injected myself with a whole bottle of insulin in 2015 and ended up in the hospital, she had reached out and then I was crying and said, this will happen. And then she had stayed with me. She had to ask me what to tell the doctor, what to say, and what I could do to help. Mm-hmm. And I have this other friend, Lade. You know, Lade had been, I mean, she had been a friend, a mentor, a prayer warrior, everything. On a particular day, I had just left my house when I was in Abuja. I had just left my house. And you know, I was feeling suicidal again, and I left my house in my PJ at 10 p.m. and went to the road. And for some reason, she said she just had a feeling to call me, and she was in the UK, and it was 10 p.m. in the night, so she called me. I didn't want to pick up, so I just said, okay, whatever, let me just answer her, because she kept calling. And I picked up, and I just broke up crying, and she was like, where am I? So I said I was on the road, that, you know, I don't know, I'm just going, that I'll start alive and everything, because I was actually waiting for it to get a bit dark, and then I'll run into an oncoming vehicle or something. But she stayed with me on the phone. And when she saw that I wasn't going to get off the phone and I wasn't going to go back home, because she knows I like ice cream. So she told me, oh, do I want ice cream? I said, no, I don't want ice cream. I don't want anything. So she said, okay, she sent me 10,000 naira. So she had my account details. She said, oh, there's, you know, Mr. Biggs near where you're standing. Can you go there? She stayed on the phone for me for 1 hour. She made sure I bought the ice cream and I got back home and I treated my freezer. And then I slept up. And somehow she had reached out to someone in Nigeria to check up on me and everything. Mm-hmm. If Ali had not called me that night or stayed with me, I don't know what would have happened to me.
Right.
So I have a friend in Manchester, Uje. Uje has come to Nigeria every year to spend Christmas with me over the last 7 years. So I have a few support system that, if not for them, and then I have this other friend in the US. I mean, I can't really share his details and everything, but he had called me and he had stood by me. I mean, and sometimes, some days, it's just them talking to me and just helping me to, because sometimes I forget who I am or who I was when I was depressed. I mean, they start telling me about myself and things I've done and how I could do it again. It's ironic because I was in Nigeria and I was in deepest places, but there were people across the world that actually supported and carried me through this journey. I think that was one thing that carried me, like, if these people believed I could make it and helped me. But different people at different points. And I have this friend that he literally rented a place for me in Abuja, picked me up, put me in a hotel for like 12 days until he found the place, put me in a hot tub. And he was just my colleague from ExxonMobil. But he said, this is not the chinas I know. I don't know what's going on with you, but I know that you're going to be fine. And he paid for rent for me for a whole year, fixed up the place. I mean, got me basic stuff and all of that. And for me, those are things I can't put a price to. And so, and for me, that's also my inspiration to share on Instagram. Beyond my social media advocacy, I look forward to someday, you know, having a support structure where people with depression that feel like they have nowhere to go, they have nowhere to start over, can actually have a home. I mean, like, you're depressed and you reach out and you don't have anywhere to go, you can actually stay in the shelter and start your life again. You need a place to heal. You need a place to start over. And sometimes going to a new place helps. And for me, that really helped me, going to a new place.
Oh, that's amazing. This is such an eye-opening episode. I'm learning so much from you. I'm learning about things that I probably heard about or I've read in a textbook, but just to hear someone who is currently living that life talk about it, it's even more powerful this way. So does sharing your story help you feel better?
Well, sharing my story doesn't help me feel better. Writing helps me feel better. So like, I have a lot of journals that I write. So like, I have more than 6 journals right now from, you know, over the years. I mean, some I've destroyed because what I've written in them are so horrible. I'm like, this couldn't have been me.
Right.
But I feel better when someone reaches out to me going through depression and tells me my story helps them. And I've had a few people through this journey. That's my healing. Pain is not wasted. When people reach out to real people that can connect with you, reach out to you.
Yes.
You know, it helps me. So that's when I kind of, sharing my story helps me. I mean, I had someone who sent me a picture that she had her knife and she was ready to take her own life, but I understood where she was because I've been there. So she was just tired of life. So I said, okay, put down the knife and everything. I called her, stayed on the phone with her, you know, sent her money, asked her to go see the GP, and then we just talked. And she held on to another a few more days, and she was eventually going to go and see her, take her medication. So sometimes for me, that's when I have those kind of situations, that's when sharing my story has helped. And every time I share my story, maybe a few weeks after, somebody looks at a post that I've made a long time ago. And then also, like, when I have a burden to share, I do, because I just feel like I don't know where, but someone in the world probably needs to hear this today.
Right. And thank you so much for sharing, because that's also how I connected with you on Instagram, from your posts. Okay, so let's move a little bit away from clinical depression and talk about, what are your hobbies? Like, I know you do a lot of things. How do you do all these things? Because you talk about how, you know, you get overwhelmed, sometimes you get depressed, but then looking at your life on social media, or just following your posts and following the activities, you know, one day I'm talking to you in Nigeria, another day I'm talking to you, you're in the UK. So what are other things that you do that bring you joy?
Well, yeah, writing is like my number one passion now. Is like something I discovered, you know, mm-hmm. in the course of my depression.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote, you know, basically for my own healing process. So when I had negative feelings, when I cried, and I wrote, and then eventually, of course, like I discovered that I could write, and then I had this opportunity to write for Business News. But I cook. I like to cook.
Okay.
I'm a foodie. I travel. Okay. I like to travel. You know, like I think traveling is healing and soothing for me, but it's adventurous. I like to just explore new places, do something new. I get bored doing one. So I think that's majorly, you know, those two. I used to run. I mean, I hope to start running again.
Okay. So I could tell from your Instagram that you're a foodie, because I see a lot of posts about food, and I'm just like, oh, some days I'm hungry and I look at your Instagram, like, I can't even be here right now. I just go look at something else, because like almost every other post, the food part always gets me all the time. I know you have a website. So can you tell our listeners your website name, and your also where they can find you on Instagram if they want to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So I share my journey with depression on adajoblog.wordpress.com. So mm-hmm. if you want to read a bit of my story in the past and follow me for the future,
mm-hmm.
I can promise you have some interesting, some scary, some awesome, and some mind-blowing stories along, because basically I just share it as it is and as mm-hmm. I'm inspired. And of course I love pictures. Oh, I love taking pictures. So photography is the other thing I do. I mean, every other day I'm deleting pictures off my phone to create memory. So I love to take pictures. On Instagram is adajo247, and then I'm on Twitter as Miss Adajo.
Okay.
And if you want to connect with me professionally, I'm on LinkedIn, and it's just Chinazo Onyebuchi. That's my full name.
Okay.
So at least that gives you like a bit of what I've done professionally. If you want to send me a direct message, just send me an email, and it's my name and my surname at yahoo.com. So that's Chinazo Onyebuchi, Chinazor Onyebuchi at yahoo.com. For me, my team for 2019 is leaving. I just want to leave, because I've been given another chance. It's 7 years. And for me, 7 is the number of perfection. So it's this year, it's just take it easy, leave, create more businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, well, tomorrow I'm officially starting a journey to do an MSc in Innovation Management and Entrepreneurship at Beaumont University. So I'm going back to school for the whatever time to do a third degree.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hopefully a PhD is in line for a third degree, but maybe not. I mean, I have a passion for law. So which is something I wanted to do at university level, and I want to still do someday. So I tell myself, I didn't see myself going back to school, but I guess that we are not done with reading books. Like, I'm back to school full time, but I would also be supporting businesses across Nigeria and the UK. I'm writing business plans in my spare time. I'm thinking about doing working as a graduate assistant with my MBA, because I have an MBA. I want to try my passion and my hands of teaching, and make use of my certificate. So I'll see how that works. I mean, I might end up a lecturer. In a final question, which I would ask myself and answer, is when are you getting married? But yeah, you know, like people always ask you that question. So before you ask, let me ask. But for me, like, I'm an only daughter. So my mom expected for me to get married when I was young. I mean, I graduated at 19. So at 20, I was expected to get married. In fact, even in 2012, when I moved back, I had a lot of stories that I was getting married, and I'm thinking, okay, I'm getting married. I'm not even aware that I'm going to be at my own wedding. Over the years, you know, my mom has gotten to the fact that this girl is not going to get married because society expects her to. And society, I mean my family. Thankfully, my brother is married. He's got 2 kids, so I'm not under that pressure of grandchildren. But I feel that marriage is a long-time commitment. You bring 100% of yourself to it. And a lot of time, people feel like they're finding their half-partner. No one is half. So if you have things from the past and scars, you need to heal for it. And for me, I'm on a journey of healing, you know, and dealing with a lot of things. So if I find love, or love finds me in the process, that's fine. But someday, like, yeah, marriage will happen, but it will be a whole me and a whole other person, and, you know, having it forever after. I've learned over my journey with relationships that love is not enough, but love is important. And for me, I will marry for love and not because society expects me to. That said, I have an interest in marrying Australian or Canadian. Set me up, like, you know, Meghan's friend set out to marry the prince. Yeah. Does that.
Thank you so much for, you know, giving us a little bit more. I wasn't planning to ask you when you were going to get married. No, I don't think that's an appropriate question to ask people. But I love that you gave us that little bit more information, because that's definitely the icing on the cake. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Thank you so much for giving us all this information, sharing, you know, the journey so far. I know it hasn't been easy. I know it's something that probably hurts you to, you know, talk about it, but I appreciate the fact that you're doing this. I'm very proud of you. I'm very motivated, you know, inspired by you, because you doing this and having all these dreams and goals, and I'm just like, you're unstoppable. So I'm very, very happy that you decided to share your story on the podcast, and I'm going to go ahead and put all the information online so that if people want to reach you, they know exactly where to reach you. So thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ozi, for doing this, for letting me share my story on your podcast. I really appreciate it. For me, it's a privilege. And I want to say to those who are in a dark place, I mean, I call everyone who's depressed being in a dark pit, because that's what it feels like. I just want to say, you are not alone. And I just want to say, help is out there. Accept where you are. You are ill and you are not doomed. You're not helpless. You're not hopeless. Mm-hmm. There is a bright light. There is a rainbow coming. I know it's hard, and sometimes you can't even reason and understand, but choose life. Reach out and look for help. Even if you can't look for, just hold on. I mean, just speak into the universe and say, I need help. Acceptance, you need help and you're ill, is the beginning of your healing process. And for those who have loved ones going through depression, it's hard for you, and I know, but you also need to accept that they are ill and they are not crazy. They are not mental and they are not being spiritually manipulated, and that it's okay. They are going to be well. And that it's okay to take antidepressants. It's okay to see a psychiatrist. It's okay to go to the hospital. And it's also okay to find out how you can help professionally and find out what you can do. And if you can't do anything, it's okay to let someone else help them. It's okay to pay for help for them. It's okay to just be there and be quiet. It's okay to just hug them. It's okay to just have hope for them when they cannot have hope. And it's okay to know that they're going to be all right, and it's not a death sentence, and it's not something to be shameful about, and it's not something that destroys your family name or image. It is their life that they are struggling with. To everyone, whether you're depressed or not, depression is real. We need to start doing something about it. We have just one life to live, and we've been given this life to live. It's up to us to live the very best we can. Sometimes you don't have a control over what happens to you. You don't have a control over what kind of illness you're going to go through or what kind of situation you're going to be, but you have a control over how you react to it and what you choose to make up out of it. And anyone can rise from the ashes. If I can rise from it, if I can live the life I live, then anyone can rise from the ashes of depression, and anyone can be whole again.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. So guys, if you would like to hear more about this, I will have all the information available on my Instagram page, African Princess in America. Have an amazing day, guys. Thank you, Chinazo.
All right, thank you, Dr. Z. Bye now.
Do you know that you can support this podcast with a small monthly contribution, as little as a dollar every month? If you'd like to do so, please visit our website at www.talesofanafricanprincessinamerica.com. Thank you.